Welcome to Killer Women with your host, best-selling author, Danielle Girard. And now, Danielle's next killer woman.
Hello, and welcome to Killer Women Podcast, a proud member of the Authors on the Air global network with more than 4 million listeners. I am your host, suspense author Danielle Girard, and my guest today is Alyssa Cole. Alyssa is an award-winning New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of thrillers and romance, historical, contemporary, and sci-fi. Her books have received critical acclaim from Library Journal, BuzzFeed, Kirkus, Booklist, Jezebel, Vulture, Book Riot, Entertainment Weekly, and various other outlets, basically everybody. When she's not working, she can be found watching anime or wrangling her many pets. Welcome, Alyssa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, this is so fun. So I was telling Alyssa before we started airing that this is the first Alyssa Cole book I've read, but it will not be the last. I will get to go back now and read all the backlist. So, and obviously everyone's heard your name. There's been lots of fun buzz about you for a long time now. So before we get into all the good juicy stuff about this book, can you tell our listeners a little bit about One of Us Knows?
One of Us Knows. It's kind of a hard book to fit into an elevator pitch because there's everything in the kitchen sink.
Kind of, yes.
But I would say it's a very ambitious, I guess, if we want to frame it positively. Ambitious. Yeah. So it's a psychological thriller about a dissociative identity disorder system. The main protagonist is who I guess would be the bad guy in that system, who has been dormant for several years and wakes up to discover that they have a job as caretaker of a historical home on an island in the Hudson River. And she has missed a lot while she was gone. And once they get to the island, they discover some disturbing things, possibly a ghost. The people who hired her show up and they're maybe not so good. There are some people from her past. Mm-hmm. And so, but like to sum it up without all the details, it's a psychological thriller. That's a dual locked room mystery. In addition to having gothic elements of, and a bit of horror elements as well.
Like you said, kind of a kitchen sink. And let's talk about how ambitious it is. This part of one of the locked room mysteries is actually inside a single human being, right? It's you are dealing with, now I'm going to not be able to count them correctly, but basically there's five or six altars.
Seven? There's like one of them is not really very talkative. Yeah. He's kind of in the background and then
Lurk.
Yes.
They have such great names too. And there's Empress and there's Kiki and there's Solomon and there's Ken and there's Delia. Yes. I mean, there's a lot of characters and you do a beautiful job because it sometimes, you know, when we have a lot, it's like in any book where there's like eight or nine protagonists, we're sort of like, oh my God, how are we keeping track? But these characters are so beautifully drawn in such succinct ways that we know kind of immediately who is who in this world. And it is beautifully done. She's not even just been gone. The main character, you know, the main alter, Ken, has been gone for, isn't it 6 years?
She slept through all of the election stuff, through COVID. So she wakes up, she's like, there's a plague. Like what's going on?
I love that. Don't we all wish we'd slept through COVID? And she does. She ends up on this island. She has no idea. And then the altar who's gotten them there, right? The sort of secondary altar. Now she's gone. So it's sort
and
of
she,
like.
Yes. So there's this whole aspect of, and Ken does not want to be there. She's very much like, everyone hates me. I hate me. It's better for everyone if I'm not here. But the only one who can take her place is the other headmate who is missing. So there are so many moving parts. Everyone knows a little bit of something, but everyone, even though they share the same body and the same brain, they all don't know the same information, and some of them are purposely keeping information from each other, and some of them don't know if they can trust one another or themselves. So
And I love that they're called headmates. Like, you know, there's all these people sharing the head. And I love the fact, and I know this is true, actually, of the disorder, that they have different skills, right? Like that, you know, somebody might be very good at, you know, somebody might be like a fabulous cook, and the other person has no idea how to cook, even though I'm sure it's a horrible disease. I don't mean to make light of it. But in this scope of this book, there's so much humor in the fact that, you know, that nobody kind of knows what's going on. So one of the things that we talked about and that I want to talk about is because this is Killer Women, and so we focus on sort of female issues, and a lot of the stuff that, you know, there is all this sort of shame, and there's a lot of women in this system. There is one singular man, Solomon, and he's quite extraordinary. I have to say I have a crush on, I'm not the only one, but I have a crush on Solomon. But tell us, you know, how did this happen for you? Like, how did this develop? And how did Solomon become the singular man? Because I thought that was really interesting.
So for the book itself, I really wanted to write, you know, I had this idea for a book about dissociative identity disorder. And one of the things I tend to do with my writing, or that I like to do, is kind of take an idea and subvert it. I mean, obviously I'm not the only one. Most writers like trying to do that to some extent. And for me, something that I like playing with is perceptions of mental health and how that can be played with in a thriller, the preconceived notions, and also the ways that characters can be presented differently. And one thing, and I don't have dissociative identity disorder. I try to be very careful. I generally am, you know, no matter what I'm writing, no matter the background of the character, I do try to be careful, because my main thing is, you know, if someone with dissociative identity disorder picks up the book, I don't want them to be like, okay, great, another book where someone is kind of like treating us like a gimmick or something.
Right.
So
right.
For me, the thing was kind of like, in most thrillers and TV shows and movies, it's often the person doesn't know they have dissociative identity disorder, and they usually find out in a really negative way. And I kind of wanted to play around with that, about like what happens after, what happens when you know, and what happens as you try to reconcile with that. And also how, instead of making it into this like horrible thing, even though it's like something that's born out of trauma and, you know, can be very difficult for the people living with it, how can I take this and kind of, you know, first of all, make an interesting thriller, and also, like, as far as character, have the characters be realistic, and also kind of be this kind of like ragtag band of misfits, but they're all in the same body.
Yeah. I mean, actually, that's a very valid point. And I think, you know, let's first off say, I do think that the handling of the disorder is very respectful. And I think that is really important, especially because, as we know, mental health is, you know, is so, it's just, you don't deal with it honestly. We don't take it seriously in this country. We're very dismissive of, you know, it becomes this thing like an addiction, like you're a drug addict or mentally ill. And there, you know, there's so much nuance, and there's so much trauma built into all of these disorders. So that is very fair.
Realized that I didn't answer your question. Oh, okay, yeah. I do have ADHD. So if I start like,
you're great.
But basically, so how did Solomon and the System come about? One of the things, so when I was researching, so I had so many ideas about how things could go, but I did so much research. I generally do it anyway, no matter when I'm writing, because I, you know, I have ADHD, but also because I wanted to make sure I was getting things right. And I also, one of the things I like to do is like come up with ideas for things and then make sure that they are within the wheelhouse, like within the realm of possibility, which is like sometimes funny to me when people are like, if they read something in, you know, a particular book, and they're like, oh, that's so unbelievable. And I'm like, actually, I researched Most times when someone points at something that's like unbelievable, I'm like, actually, that's something that really happened, or like that can really happen. But with this book, when I was thinking, when I was looking at systems and different kinds of setups, and often, you know, they're generally made of all different kinds of people, and sometimes not people, sometimes, you know, non-humans, and sometimes people from the real world, and sometimes people from characters from books and things like that. But often they are just whole. It's more often when they just are there. It's not like, oh, here's my mom, here's my cut. Like, you know, they, you don't have to know these people. They are usually not all the same race. But I was like, it can happen. So I'm doing that in this book just because that's how I envision them. But it's one of those things where I also wanted to be clear, like that's actually not the case. And that can make it very interesting for some people. If they, you know, if some, if it, you know, their race doesn't match their physical appearance, and then in addition to gender and things like with Solomon. But so I had this idea for the system. And then with Solomon, I really kind of just wanted him to be kind of the voice of reason, and kind of him and Ken having this particular connection to each other. Because also, so the way I also looked at it is, you know, some people are like, oh, there's a bunch of different people inside of one body, which is one way of looking at it. Then there's also the way that I looked at it, so that I could try to better write it from my perspective, or things that I experienced, is thinking about it as like executive function, which, you know, I don't really have, or have a little bit of, but like, so thinking about things like, for example, mm-hmm. There are many people who have it and don't even know, because in a way it is just the brain performing various executive functions. The person who knows, the headmate that knows how to cook, might not even have a name. They just come forward and they cook when it's time to cook, and then they go back. And often people who then do go on to discover that they have this, later on, maybe they realize that that's another person, that person has a name. But some people don't know, and they never know, because it's just taking a general function of the brain that everyone has, the different parts of the brain that handle various tasks. But it, you know, there are other headmates, and they're doing it, or they start to come forward, or they're more structurally solid, I guess, more than just a thought going, hey, we need to go cook now. It's like, okay, actually, I'm coming to cook, and my personality that I have that is different from this other personality is now going to be at the forefront. So with Solomon, yeah, I kind of really, he was much stricter when I first imagined him. I really kind of imagined him as kind of like a remains of the day type, like, very rigid. And I was like, okay, he can be a little bit, he's still rigid, but like a little bit more relaxed than I initially imagined him. And then at a certain point, I was really stuck with the book, and I was like, what is good? Because they're fighting. And I was like, oh, I understand why they are fighting so much now. So then I had to kind of re-envision some aspects of their relationship, which was fun for me because I'm a romance writer. So I was like, oh,
yes,
like have like dual romances too. So
I have to say, I think, yeah, he is for, certainly the most sort of like rationally organized of the characters. But I think it's interesting also, like what you said about the idea that they're different races. And I, you know, one of the themes in the book is, of course, about, you know, race, and about the way that, you know, this, how this whole system was created, comes, as you said, born of trauma. And I was curious about that. Like, you know, so is it, you know, do we find that the personalities are on different races because it's, is there like a, is there any sort of evidence that comes because of race trauma that we then sort of dissociate that way?
That might be true. I'm not like an expert, but from what I read, there isn't really any rhyme or reason. When it's someone who's not like an introject or someone from that is like exist in the real world or a character that exists in the real world when it's just like a random person, often it's there's not really any connection or I think it just it seems to me to be like really something that's limited by the personality. I mean, sorry, by the imagination of the person. Because there are some people who actually don't have inner worlds. There are people who don't know what the other headmates look like. They don't consider them headmates. They consider them part of themselves. So like there are so many variations along the spectrum. So it's like in the same way that some people don't see things when they read books or they don't hear things, like they just see the words. Like so I think that's how I tried to think of it too when I was imagining how other systems might be. Like there are some people who are just like, okay, we're here in the brain, and those people probably don't see anything when they read. Whereas people who see everything when they read are the people who have like multi-layered multi-dimensional systems going on. So yeah, it can really vary from what I read.
Which makes total sense. Another thing I want to talk about is the setting, right? So these people live inside this, you know, their inner world is incredibly rich, right? They live in a castle. And I love the idea that, you know, not all of them have seen all parts of that, of the castle, which of course makes sense also. But you know, so where do the, I mean, obviously the castle comes into play later in the story, and we're not going to talk about that too much because you have to read this book. So, but tell us about, like, you know, how that was born, because I've never, you know, and you do have, obviously you are somebody, you're incredibly creative. So this is not outside your wheelhouse, but it was such a different way to think about the inner workings of a system of altars. So tell us, you know, how did that come to be?
So one of the reasons I was interested in dissociative identity disorder is, okay, this is going to go on a slight tangent, but it's slightly related.
Go.
So I don't know if you experience this, but sometimes when I dream, I have dream places or dream houses or dream neighborhoods that I sometimes will just like randomly be like, oh yeah, I was here in my other dream. And it's like, oh yeah, and that's like the street I was in, or this is the house I was in. And like with some people, and this is again, like the, do you see things when you read? Sometimes I've spoken to people and been like, oh, you know, like when you have like a dream place or like a dream neighborhood, and they're like, what are you talking about? Like I've never gone back to the same place in a dream. And then there are other people I've spoken with who have been like, yeah, for my entire life, I've dreamed of like this same dream house, or I've dreamed of this same dream neighborhood, or just like for a couple of months, I kept like ending up in the same place in my dreams. And so what I always like, I was just like kind of really fascinated with that. Like our brains can just create these places in our heads that we revisit when we go to sleep. And then when I was reading about dissociative identity disorder, I was like, this to me just seems like like the aspect of the inner world just seems like an extension of that, of our brains' capability to create like multi, you know, 3D solid places that you can visit, know the details of. And this just seems to be enhanced by dissociative identity disorder. So with the castles, like I love castles, I love sword, you know, all kinds of that, and like fairy tales and things like that. That's like, you know, a recurring theme. I have like books that are like fairy tale retellings. This one here, which is like set in like medieval Scotland. So like those are things that I'm interested in. But the castle itself, and the location of the book was inspired by a place called Polapel Island, or Bannerman's Island, or Bannerman's Castle. It's in the Hudson River, and you can go there. They have tours. It's not the castle, and everything else is not like exactly the castle. Doesn't look the same at all as described in the book. But in real life, it was owned by a man who was an immigrant, made a lot of money selling weapons, and he used it as a weapon stockpile. And he built this kind of like gigantic thing that looked like a castle that was actually the place where they were stockpiling the weapons once it became too dangerous to stockpile them like in New York. And eventually it blew up. It burned down.
Cool.
And so I saw that place, like, I was on a train actually, and I saw, and like, so I'm like obsessed with castles. I'm like, what is
Yeah.
this castle doing in the middle of the river? And I was like, why does no one talk about the fact that there's like a castle sitting?
I love that. Yeah.
So like, and like, this was like years ago, and I was like, one day I'm gonna find a way to put that in a book. And I did. It took like maybe 15 years, but I eventually found a way. But yeah, so I was just kind of also thinking about, you know, the period, the time period where people were just building castles, you know, the Gilded Age, and the way that many of the issues of that time have started to reappear in the present day. I mean, like, we don't have our robber barons, our tech, I don't know what you would call them. They're not barons. Tech bros, I guess.
Yeah,
much
and
less fancy
finance.
names.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
finance people. And but like also the politics of the time, the societal ethics of the time, and the ways that people, you know, politicians and society tried to subjugate women at the time, as well as other, you know, as other minorities. So I was kind of, you know, thinking about, like, one thing that I really like exploring in my books is how the past and the present are always so like intertwined with one another.
Yeah.
And the same thing, the same issues just keep repeating over and over again, or they never go away. We just kind of stop talking about them. So yeah, I kind of wanted to link the issues of the past with some of the issues of today as well. So kind of using this historical place that has this, like many historical homes, is being kind of used in a modern way, but also in a world that still has many of the same problems, I guess.
Yeah, and it is, I mean, really what happens on that island, and we're not going to talk about that, but what happens there is very much something that is probably going on right now in this, I mean, in our country, in, you know, multiple places. It's really, yeah, it's very, it's beautifully done. And okay, so let's, I mean, I have so many thoughts, but so I love the fact that I love the fact that you are, like, you sort of are, you're a romance writer, you're a thriller writer. Thrillers are new. You were writing romance before you started writing thrillers, right?
Yes.
So what sort of, because that's more recent. Tell us about sort of what happened when you were like, okay, now I need to kill somebody, or whatever it was.
Well, I actually do kill a lot of people in my romances. I have two romances where the meet cute happens over a dead body.
Oh, I love that. Okay. So it's not that new for you.
Yeah.
But what was the sort of trigger? Yeah.
So yeah, basically, like, I enjoy having a mystery element in my romances. And I, like, my first romance that was published was Romantic Suspense. It's not out anymore, but so with thriller, so some of my romances are a bit darker. Like, I have a Civil War espionage romance series that's a little more like domestic suspense plus romance. But like, I didn't really, you know, at the time I was just like, I'm writing historical romance with spies, but it also could, like, you know, there's overlap with domestic suspense.
Yeah.
And so moving toward thriller, there were some things that I felt like, even if I could address them in romance, it couldn't be in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Or, and there are like some really dark romances, but for the kind of romances that I was writing, I was like, okay, I can also write thrillers that have romantic elements that are able to more directly tackle some of these issues and like lean more into the kind of scary or suspenseful or anxiety inducing aspect of the story. And like the thing, so like I have two books that I have before I wrote When No One Is Watching, which is a gentrification thriller. I had a romance novel that where I first started to kind of explore that idea of gentrification. And it was going to be a bigger part in the story, but this romance novel was also like a rom-com about a woman who is the apprentice of a sword maker and finds out he's the secret love child of a duke. That's already a lot of stuff going on. The gentrification stuff kind of fell to the wayside, even though it's like a little there in the story. And I was like, okay, so this wasn't the best vehicle to explore that, even though it's like a little bit there. Then, and no one is watching, I was able to put it to the forefront of the story and to really lean into like how scary and like unnerving it can be. And then there's some romance instead of like having, okay, we're having this romance.
Right.
And also this gentrification thing is happening.
Okay, so. Wait, I read When No One Is Watching. And I love that. There's that, I'm not going to talk too much about it, but there's like the building underground, right? It's so funny. The problem is I read too many books and I read it when it came out and I didn't connect it with you, but that was fabulous too. Okay. I'm officially an Alyssa Cole fan now. I've read two. But okay, yes. Okay, I remember that. And I can see, that was another. Yeah, I love how you really walk the edge of, I don't want to say, it's not like, it's, there's some surrealism in all, in your stuff, which I really, really enjoy. You're bumping against the edge of really dark, really dark stuff, which is fabulous for me. I love that. Okay, I apologize. I didn't, my little brain did not put that together. But okay, so you did, so When No One Was Watching, that was your first straight sort of thriller.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I can see, I think that's fair. And now that we're not so pigeonholed, right? It used to be sort of that the publishing industry would be like, if you're going to write something different, you have to do it under a different name or you have to, and I think you're on the forefront of that because I feel like that's really just, people are really starting to do that now, but you kind of, how did you convince your publisher?
No, they were fine with it. I generally, because I write so many different things, and this is something like at the beginning, you know, when I first started writing and then there were the people who were like, okay, you have to have a different, because like in romance, that even for different subgenres, people were recommending that you have different pen names. And I was like, that I can't do that. I was like, I can barely mention, I can barely manage this one. Like
I can only remember one name. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Like that's just too much work. And I was like, also, I feel like for me, I considered it as if readers like me, my writing for one story, they will probably like it for another genre as well, even if it's not something they usually read. And, you know, that's generally proven itself to be true. If someone didn't, they're not going to come and tell me like, oh, by the way, I didn't like that other book in that genre. But like, because like, it just wasn't feasible for me. For example, like my first series was like the first book was, you know, they were all different kinds of couple pairings and stuff like that. And I was like, okay, we can't, like, it's not like I can separate my name for each different book within one series even, because these technically are in different subgenres. So I was like, I'm just not going to do it. And I just kept going.
I love it.
There
You're like, no.
Luckily,
no.
Luckily people were fine with it. Thank goodness.
And I think actually it's really up to the publisher to package it in a way that says,
exactly,
you know, this is, I mean, clearly, you know, you might get romance in this, but this is not a romance novel. I mean, you can tell. And I think readers are savvy enough to read the blurb and to say, okay, if I want a romance, I'm going to pick a different Alyssa Cole book than this one. And if I love that, then I'll try, you know, this other thing. I think that's, and I love that we're getting flexibility because it's, you're not just one type of writer, right? There's not just one type of story.
And it's really, I really have noticed over the years too, like more and more writers like writing in different genres under the same name. And it's like fun. It's like, we have so many different stories that we want to tell that so many people, I know, so like in the past and even in the recent past, and maybe even now, people have felt like, oh, well, I can't write that because, you know, I write this, and so I'm not allowed to write this fantasy story, or I'm not allowed to write this science fiction story. When I think readers are happy to read anything. Like
Yeah.
very few readers, I think, will be like, why are you writing this instead of like
Right. And you
what
get to
you deserve
choose. You
it.
don't have to read every, they don't have to pick up every single book just because it has a name that you know. Like, I mean, there's so many options. So giving, and what we have to do this for a living, so we might as well just get to do what we want to do, right?
Exactly.
Now, are you actively working on like multiple books at a time?
I generally am at least thinking of multiple books. It's not really, it's hard for me to write two books at the same time. Like
Sure.
I often like I can pause and like write a short story or but writing two books at the same time is pretty difficult for me.
Good to hear, because it's really impossible for most people.
Yeah, I know some people are like very disciplined and they're like in the morning for 2 hours I work on this book and then in the evening I work on this book and I'm like
Wow.
I can't switch like that, unfortunately. I wish I could.
But you are still publishing different genres of different books all the time. You do one and
Yes.
then you do the other, and then you're sort of,
Yes.
yeah, wow. I mean, even like, I think to write a book like this, most of us are feeling really good if we write one thriller a year. So, you
Yes,
go. That's
this one took
impressive.
me I actually this book took me the longest to write than anything, longer than anything else I've ever written. And it was like not because it wasn't even like really writer's block or it was like a very weird kind of writer's block where I was just like getting overly like focused on certain aspects of the story or like figuring out the character thing, but like just kind of trying to juggle so many different elements
Yeah.
basically made my brain short out.
Yeah, I mean, I
But
can see that, which is actually that's an important, I think, lesson that you've learned, or we can learn from this, is that you obviously took the time it needed, because you could have tried to force it out and then it wouldn't have had the power it has. It wouldn't have had the, I mean, you have made it simple for us. You know what I mean? I mean, not simple, but digestible for us by taking the time you needed to get the book right.
yeah, and like for me, that was like, I felt super guilty about being really late. But at the same
Yeah.
time, I was like, okay, people have other books to read.
Yeah.
All of my other writers are out there writing their books and publishing their books. Readers are going to be reading those. Publishers are going to
Yeah.
be publishing those. And although, missing deadlines and stuff doesn't feel good.
Of course.
Basically, what you said though is how I think of it. No matter how quickly I want to finish a book, I can't force it. And if I force it, I feel like that's more of a, I feel like that's worse for the readers and for the people who
Yeah.
pick it up than having to wait for a
Yeah, it's
while.
a disservice to the story. And yeah, and you want to give it your, I mean, you're professional, right? So you're like, I'm gonna wait and give this my, my best. I'm not going to get it out there until it's really at its best. Well, it was so enjoyable, and I'm so tickled to know that I've read another of your stories. That okay. I want to read one little quote, because this is the kind of humor that I found so fun. And you will find many of these moments, but this was the first one I noticed. I spent my entire life chasing acceptance, purpose, a definitive success that could be measured against my countless failures. Every time I had one of them in my grasp, I squeezed too hard, too fast, either crushing it into a mangled mess or watching it slip from my greedy fingers like a Valdez greased penguin. Which is, that's the kind of sort of like dark, right? Dark, fabulous humor that we find in this book. So, anyway, Alyssa, this was such a fun read. Thank you
Thank
for
you so
joining us
much.
today. Tell us where we can find you. I know you're on Instagram,
I
and are
am
you on
on
Facebook? Yeah.
Instagram, mostly on Instagram. I sometimes peek into Twitter, but I haven't really posted anything. I don't even know if I post anything about this book. I need to go do that. I'm on Blue Sky and I'm on TikTok. And sometimes I am trying to post on TikTok again. Before I was just like looking at videos of animals and stuff. But I'm trying to actually use it, so you can find me on there too.
Wonderful. One of Us Knows by Alyssa Cole. This was a super, super fun read, as you can tell. Head over to Facebook to our Killer Women page. We will be doing a giveaway of Alyssa's book. And thank you so much again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was great talking to you.
So fun. Everyone, this was Killer Women with Alyssa Cole, and we will see you next time. Bye.